Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Robert Johnson, a York Rite Mason and Knight Templar. Nothing to report this week. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I had to work, but I had the evening to myself and I spent it with my family. I received the new issue of Knight Templar magazine, and I thought we would start off this episode by continuing the series, The Quest for the Holy Grail and the Modern Knights Templar, which is from the latest issue, December 2011, number 12, by Sir Knight Reverend Frederick A. Shade. The Quest for the Holy Grail and the Modern Knights Templar, the third in a series. And now permit me to show the close similarity and possible identity between the Grail and the Templar Hollows. An example, those revered objects and signs which they have in common. In the Templar ritual, there appears the Order's own hollows. There are four in number. 1. There is a cup. It first appears in the Templar ritual as the cup of refreshment, and is given to the weary pilgrim on his arrival. It contains water only. Later in the ceremony, it becomes the cup libation and memory, which is partaken of by the novice. On this occasion, it contains wine. 2. The dish of bread, which is the food given to the pilgrim on his arrival. 3. The stone, which is written within and without. A new name is given to the novice after it is consecrated by his blood. It is only then that the secret within the stone is revealed. It contains the name of the divine child. 4. The skull of mortality, with which the novice undertakes a year of penance and with which the imprecations are made. There are several other hollows and sacred signs in the Templar tradition. Some of the lesser hollows of the Grail cycle are suggested here, such as the Templar crucifix, with the nails prominently displayed thereon. There is the knight's sword, which is to be wielded in defense of the faith, and also his shield, all of which are beautifully explained in the quotation from St. Paul. They may not necessarily come directly from the Grail legend, but they certainly evoke many aspects of that tradition and resonates as hollows in their own right. I will mention one other, which is very important in the Templar tradition. I refer to the sepulcher, which appears as the central item in the preceptory furnishings. In all my researches, I have been unsuccessful in finding an explanation as to the significance of the sepulcher in the preceptory. Presumably, it is empty, but why do we guard it? It is the Lord's sepulcher at Golgotha, or is it perhaps our own tomb, as some have suggested? No one can tell me, but I do believe it is there for a very important reason, one of which perhaps the modern order of the temple is not even aware. The Order of Constantine tells us something of the mystery in its appendant order of the Holy Sepulcher, but only a little. In any case, the sepulcher in the Templar tradition could have an entirely different meaning. Any ideas? This is where the Grail cycle, as well as the hollows of the Christian Church, could help us in answering these questions. The writings of A.E. Waite have helped me unravel this particular mystery, but there is a long way to go yet. The knights keep watch over an empty sepulcher, and this is suggestive of it having a spiritual significance as well as the possible historic context. It is empty, some suggest, so that the spirit might draw all things to it. It is also for a similar reason that the sacred cup of the Grail is exalted and beyond our reach. The cup of the Grail is a temporary physical sign of something spiritual. It is seen only by a few, and then briefly. The sepulcher in the preceptory likewise is a temporary physical sign of something spiritual. This is why it is empty. It is, in a sense, a sign of resurrection of both body and spirit. I therefore suggest that the signs and hollows of these traditions, the Church, the Grail, and the Knights Templar, are pointing to a greater mystery, to things which are not really of this world. This is why we have so much difficulty in understanding what they really mean. We bring them down to our level of comprehension and lose something as a result. So each of these traditions offers us a story, a myth cycle, that is supposedly founded in history, or rather superimposed upon certain events which are claimed to be historical. They also point to a higher teaching, of which the custodians and institutions that perpetuate them know very little. The Christian Church ignores the Grail tradition as its peril in the same way as Freemasonry ignores its origins in the ancient mysteries at its peril. To ignore these things and the other underground streams of tradition and teaching which nourish the tradition will lead to a growing superficiality in both institutions. Unfortunately, That is already happening. Our traditions, Christian and Masonic, are being impoverished. It is generally accepted these days that within modern Freemasonry there exists a hidden stream which has carried the secret tradition down the centuries. It is also claimed that the Templar Knights Templar tradition has left its own mark, not only on Western spirituality, but also on the development of Freemasonry during its formative years. What is also fascinating is that even the ancient order of Knights Templary had its own hidden source and tradition. There is, for example, a Gnostic thread, as well as other non-Christian influences within the Templar tradition. But that is another story. It is important to know these things, as they help us to understand how tradition has overlapped or influenced another. In this present case, it is likely that the Grail cycle has had some influence on our ritual, if only as a source of archetypal ideals and symbols. I appreciate that I have been somewhat repetitive in what I have been saying, but I am dealing with a rather deep and abstruse material, and also ideas and theories that I find rather difficult to unravel. I can therefore only suggest these connections. A few words on the so-called sacramental aspects of these several traditions, as this gets to the very heart of the cycle. A.E. Waite says that man may enter into the consciousness of himself as being actually that vessel of reflection which testifies of everything without to the centrum concentratum within. This reminds me of the Hermetic maxim, as above, so it is below. When this comes to pass, it can be said of him, as it was said once of Percival, and the most holy grail shall appear no more herein, but in a brief space shall you know well the place where it shall be, the sacrament of the holy grail. An example, the receiving of divine grace directly, and also the vision splendid, is truly a mystical experience, a spiritual marriage given by God alone and only to the worthy knight. The story is full of mystery and of mysteries. An inward and spiritual nourishment is the reward for labor. It is the gift of grace. A few, only a few, in the Christian church, like St. Paul, have been carried up to the third heaven, and there behold the Blessed One. In the Grail tradition, the successful knight was Percival. The Grail cycle is certainly intertwined with the Christian faith, as it is written by Christians for Christians, and has a Christian message in each of its chapters. In many ways, it is written in the style of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. However, as I've said, its background is a mixture of Christian and pre-Christian or pagan traditions. It is therefore not surprising to see the merging of Grail and Eucharist and ceremonies, which at the same time have pagan or Celtic overtones. For example, the Grail service or Mass looks very much like the usual Eucharist service of the Christian Church, but they are not the same. It is therefore not surprising that the Catholic Church has never approved of the Grail cycle, as it has these heretical overtones. In the later Lohengrin romance of the German version of the Grail cycle, we find the Eucharist motif in a strange guise. In this swan story, the chain of one of the swans was made into two chalices. At Mass being said therein, the bird was restored to proper human form. Again, a symbolic representation of the transformation of the soul. Notice the reoccurring theme in these stories and legends: regeneration, transformation, and resurrection. It all appears in Freemasonry in the third degree in particular, and is implicit in many other degrees. Waite says rather poetically that the Grail itself is no more meant to be taken literally than any other fable. For this reason, it can be described as divine paradox. Likewise, the quest is not pursued with horses or clothed in outward armor, but in the realm of the spirit. Also, it is declared, Christ's blood in the Grail's cup is there, and yet it is not there. It is like the cup of elixir and the stone of transmutation in alchemy, yet it seems to be one thing under its various veils, and blessed are those who find it. Do you not see the analogy with chemical marriage of Christian Rosenkreutz? Do you not also see how important it is, the symbol of the cubic stone and the rose in the Rose-Croix degree, in the understanding of the mysteries of the Grail? And so has the crusade of the modern Knights Templar changed from that of its predecessor, for our battle is now a spiritual one, symbolically represented in the ritual, and no longer requires metal armor, a horse, and a battlefield in a foreign land. I wish to conclude my brief survey of this fascinating and somewhat complicated subject by quoting the words on the jacket of the Penguin publication of The Quest of the Holy Grail. This work is purported to have been written by the medieval author Walter Map, On the jacket, the publisher writes, "The fusion of fabulous legend and Christian symbolism gives a quest a tragic grandeur and mystical aura. The richly colorful world of the court of King Arthur is the setting for a story that was intended on another level as a guide to the spiritual life, aimed at the court rather than the cloister. Chivalrous adventurers like Gawain, Lancelot, and the saintly Galahad journey across a land strewn with fantastic dangers, temptations, and false promises. Combining Celtic myth and Arthurian romance, the quest is an absorbing and radiant allegory of man's equally perilous search for the grace of God. All I feel I can do now is to put out that question. Isn't this also the quest of the Masonic Knights Templar, the search for the grace of God? And is it not the ritual of our order, a modern-day version of the Grail cycle of medieval times?" Well, there you have it. The final in the series, The Quest for the Holy Grail and the Modern Knights Templar. Now, sometime in the coming weeks, I will read a paper that I have been working on. It will be the second time I will have read something that I have written on the show. The first was one short called The Church versus Freemasonry, which was a very short speculative essay. This one is about the esoteric and scientific meaning of the word. It's quite an interesting piece, which is actually the foreword to a short story that I'm writing. And I'll keep you all abreast on that as it happens. So, some of you have no doubt brought your Christmas tree out. I thought I would give you some of the history on the Christmas tree and who may be responsible for bringing it to America. In Britain, the Christmas tree was introduced in a time of the personal union with Hanover by George III, Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg and Strelitz in early 19th century. But the custom hadn't yet spread much beyond the royal family. Queen Victoria as a child was familiar with the custom, and a tree was placed in her room every Christmas. In her journal for Christmas Eve 1832, the delighted 13-year-old princess wrote, "After dinner, we then went into the drawing room near the dining room. There were two large round tables on which were placed two trees hung with lights and sugar ornaments, all of the presents being placed around the trees. After her marriage to the German cousin Prince Albert by 1841, the custom became even more widespread throughout Britain. In 1847, Prince Albert wrote, "I must now seek in the children an echo of what Ernest, his brother, and I were in the old time, of what we felt and thought, and their delight in the Christmas trees is not less than ours used to be." And a woodcut of the British royal family with their Christmas tree at Windsor Castle, initially published in the Illustrated London News in December 1848, was copied in the United States at Christmas 1850 in Godey's Lady's Book. Godey's copied it exactly, except for the removal of the Queen's tiara and Prince Albert's mustache, to remake the engraving into an American scene. The republished Godey's image became the first widely circulated picture of a decorated evergreen Christmas tree in America. Art historian Carl Ann Marling called Prince Albert and Queen Victoria shorn of their royal trappings the first influential American Christmas tree. Folk culture historian Alfred Lewis Shoemaker states, "In all of America, there was no more important medium in spreading the Christmas tree in the decade 1850 to 1860 than Godey's Lady's Book. The image was reprinted in 1860, and by the 1870s, putting up Christmas tree had become common in America." And Prince Albert Edward, Prince of Wales, became a Freemason and eventually was elected to serve as Grand Master in 1874 to 1901. So I guess you can thank a Freemason for your Christmas tree tradition in the United States. I hope you enjoyed that. We will move on now to this week's famous Freemason, King C. Gillette. Now in this case, King is not a title, but it is actually his first name. Born January 5th, 1855 to July 9th, 1932, the American inventor King Gillette introduced the safety razor to the market on September 28th. The American inventor King Gillette introduced the safety razor to the market on September 28th, 1901. Gillette was part of a broad socialist movement in the United States in the 1890s, who wanted to use profits from his safety razor to finance his beliefs in a new socialist system. He was raised on June 1901, demitted January 1904, at Delphi Lodge, Quincy, Massachusetts, affiliated April 1909, Columbia Lodge, Boston. The source is Trowell, Boston Grand Lodge of Masons in Massachusetts, Summer of 2003, Volume 21, Number 2, Page 22. Being a user of a straight razor, when I am clean-shaven and when I am sporting facial hair, I like to use an original one-bladed safety razor. I'd like to say thanks to this brother, but on the other hand, he's also responsible for all of us shelling out $35 for a pack of new disposables. I also found that he was quoted as saying something like, "I needed to find something people needed to do every day and then make money off of it." Shaving seemed to be the perfect thing, since this new system, the blades would get rusty, and you'd have to replace them after a few shaves. That, of course, is paraphrased. So either way, I guess thanks to the king for making shaving easier, but also more expensive. That's it for this week. I hope, as usual, you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to find us on Facebook and like the show. It will allow you to listen via Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at WhenceCameU and add us to your circle on Google+ at our email address, wcypodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead and visit the website for apps and a whole lot more at www.wcypodcast.blogspot.com. Also, I just wanted to remind everyone, Toddy Creason's books are fantastic. American Freemason series is really great. Links to the book are on Amazon and on the website as well. So until next week, have a safe and fun holiday. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.